You know, I was sort of when I was thinking about the movies that I love, I was there's some that I love and I know like the back of my hand in a certain kind of way, like know everything about them. I've seen them so many times. And there are some that are I realized as I was watching it again, actually, there are some that are like deeply have deep kind of emotional impressions on me. Realize, I probably like Dreams, for instance. I probably watched that first when I was in my early 20s, and so there is that kind of impression. But I don't know it like the back of my hand. And I was sort of excited to like revisit a movie that I haven't seen for, maybe a decade, but that I've seen several times probably in the course of that decade before that. So there's something about that that was interesting to me about it.
Welcome back to Open Forum. I'm Michael Denzel Smith. A young boy bears witness to a beautiful wedding procession, but as a result, his mother tells him that he must ask forgiveness for having watched it or take his own life. A military commander is stranded on a deserted road until he is met by the ghosts of the platoon he served over, none of them believing they have died. A man wanders the aftermath of a nuclear holocaust and finds that there are no more humans left, only demons and massive dandelions. An art student escapes into a Van Gogh painting. This week's film is Dreams, and it was chosen by Ross Gay, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Book of Delights, and the new essay collection, Inciting Joy.
Also, the impressions that I do have from it are these impressions that will never leave me, that when I saw them again, rewatching the movie, kind of images, I was again, like sort of just struck and like, oh my God, this is a movie of images.
Yeah, it very much is a movie of images and told in this way. Where, I mean, it's essentially like 8 different short films, right? Like, but it's so vibrant, especially like you consider the colors. And I think, something that struck me very early on even that first sort of vignette where, the young boy is coming across the foxes, right? And just like how colorful they are and like, all of their sort of their very deliberate movement and all of that, and like the sensuous nature of like capturing everything around them and the scenery that Kurosawa is like playing with. It's like, it's so like you get so wrapped up in the imagery that like there's a part of me that's like, oh, I have to rewatch in order to capture, to get back to what exactly like Kurosawa was trying to say with some of these things.
Yeah. I was just thinking that too, like that first vignette where, I mean, the lushness of all these images is crazy. First of all, like the later in that same little vignette, the flowers, the little boys walking through the flowers, that forest, which is like, it looks like I thought, oh, it looks like a kind of redwood forest or something, like these huge trees but the way that one shot is framed where the procession of the foxes is coming through, it's sort of framed in like this view of trees and the little boy's watching. He's like watching, it's like he's watching a movie. It's astonishing. It's also, it's so like Dreams. I'm really into Dreams. I am that person who, like, if you had dreams you wanted to talk about, I'd be all into it, which a lot of people, sadly means I'm also into talking about my dreams. And I was sort of thinking about, I've always been interested in dreams, and I was thinking about the ways that movie, I mean, dreams are, in my experience, they're often impressionistic, whether like visually or feelings, or like you just heard something, but it's kind of impressionistic. And I'm sort of really rewatching it. I was kind of like taken by how those impressions, like that's an impression, that little boy with the incredible going by, like the story, we know there's a little story, like he's going to get in trouble for seeing something he shouldn't see.
Yeah.
But the image of it or the impression of it is so palpable.
Yeah. But even then, when you're saying that, like, there's the impression of the imagery, but like the simplicity of the story that is, that's being told, and being like, okay, this little boy is going to get in trouble for seeing something that he shouldn't have seen. But you think about dreams, like the consequence is so heightened, right? Like he goes back home and his mother's like, they're going to expect you to kill yourself, right? Like, and there's a sort of shattering of childhood innocence here, right? Like the idea that like I have this desire to see the things of the world and like and take in this beauty, because like what the foxes are doing in their ceremony is so beautiful, and it's like, why wouldn't I want to see it? But there's something that like there's some ritual, some laws, something in place that, you know, determines that like I don't have access to that, and the consequence of it is, as a child, I must like take my own life. Like the shattering of childhood, it just like the idea that there is some, that like beauty can be accessible to you, right? And it's just like, it's jarring.
Yeah, it's devastating. It's really devastating. That's right. And it's also like a kind of a familiar story, like a, once you see something you can't see, or once you experience something you can't see, then you have to, whatever, in some way you're banished, or you have to go ask for forgiveness, or you have to put your face in the dirt, or whatever, the million things of like, I can't look at that.
Yeah.
Is really, I mean, it's, and also the, that when he is kind of like, has to go, when he's kicked out of his home, and he has to go, and he can't get back in until he goes and atones to the, and he may be killed by the foxes, which is just like, man, this gets so little. Yeah, but as he's walking through there, it's the most beautiful walk in the world. It's like one of those moments in the movie where it's incredibly lush, and he's going to beneath where the foxes live, beneath the rainbow, you know. Yeah. And again, it's like sort of like it has the quality of fairy tale or myth or something like that, which I think dreams often do, you know. Yeah.
It makes me think of a story, and it bleeds into the sort of the very next vignette to me. It makes me think of a story that DMX once told.
Okay.
And so DMX tells his story of being a child, like 6 or 7 maybe, and he saw a butterfly, most beautiful butterfly that he's ever seen, and he chased after the butterfly in his grandmother's yard and captured the butterfly, and in his hands that butterfly died. Yeah. And then he says he didn't see another butterfly until he was like a full grown man, like 40 years old or something. And it's just like, and him telling that story, he's like, I killed this beautiful thing, I captured it, and just like, and the realization that like it wasn't mine to hold, and then I was you know, deprived of that beauty for the rest of my life. And so yeah. I think about that in terms of like that sense of innocence dying, but then thinking about the next vignette in Dreams, where this boy is, you know, devastated by the fact that there's no peach orchard anymore, that like, because, you know, again, I think it's the foxes again here, where they're like, well, your family has chopped this down, your family has continued to, you know, defy the natural order, essentially, and so we cannot allow for this to continue blossoming. And the boy is just so stricken, he's just, and they're like, what are you crying about? He's like, peaches can be bought, but like the beauty of this, like, I just can't have. And so
it gave me chills when the kid said it too.
Yeah.
You know, it's so beautiful. It's so moving. And it's so like you, this kid is the bearer of he's punished for what his folks have done, basically.
Yeah.
And then the trees, they have to be convinced in a certain kind of way that he's actually sorry about it, you know.
Yeah,
it's really powerful. And it's also like another theme, whatever you call it, maybe, of this movie, is like this kind of ecological concern.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a story about, you know, people presumably for profit destroying an ecological moment, you know, a landscape. And the dream is reckoning with that, you know.
Yeah. This is the thing, is as I'm watching, I'm like, this is called dreams, but all of these are nightmares.
Totally. I know. Except for the last one, you know?
Except the very last one.
The last one, which is really, and I think that's beautiful too, that it starts with this little boy who's sort of like has to, you know, go on this, you know, atonement, you know, ritual. And then it ends with a funeral that's a celebration.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's actually like, I haven't done, you know, it'd be kind of fun to write about, to think about it for a while, because in a way it's like the beautiful thing about that last one, not to jump to the end, but the last one is sort of like this traveler who comes upon a village, and the village is kind of like an old ways village. It's like, you know, it's water mills and stuff. And there's an old timer there who's just like, yeah, you know, this is all, what we need is like clean air and clean water. And we're not into cutting down the trees. So we wait for the trees to fall, and that's our fuel, and or we'll use cow dung and blah, blah, blah. And he's actually mending one of the mills as he's talking the whole time. And this guy who's just like a, you know, probably like a city guy is like, oh, weird. You know? Like really taken from it. But the end, and he's also sort of moved by and confused, and sort of becomes like interested at the fact that the funeral at the end of someone who had lived a long life is a celebration. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a moment of like, you know, the way I'm sort of wondering about it is a moment of like, oh, this is a village where there's a kind of disalienated life.
Mm-hmm.
And the first sort of punishment in a way, that first one, I wonder if there's some way that it's trying to, you know, these rules that are trying to preserve the sort of an unalienated life. Mm-hmm. So there are some things you don't do. You know, the watching the foxes, whatever, might be the equivalent of like cutting down the trees.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, like how there are rituals that are like,
how
to preserve the earth, actually.
Right. I mean,
that's probably the main reason for rituals.
Yeah, and you in that last one, it's sort of like the reward for living in harmony with the earth, and like, you know, and ensure like they're still producing life. It's just not life as we, as modern city dwellings, like, you know, people like, but the reward is this long life that like at the end of it, it's not people mourning you, it's celebrating the fact that you got to live it. And I feel like, you know, I have a hard time with that, right? Like I have this very, you know, fearful relationship to death. But like the idea of accepting it and also celebrating it as both natural, but also as a means of connecting to one another and saying that like, I'm not missing you, and saying that like in a selfish way to say that like my life is going to be depleted because of your absence, but I'm celebrating the fact that you got the chance to live such a long, healthful, like community oriented and harmonious life. Like that's something that I feel like would just feel so completely alien to us.
You know? Yeah. That's right. And you know, sort of like, you know, continuing with that, I think it was the one before, one of the two before, there's this one about the demons, you know, mm-hmm. Like, it's really and the demons are sort of, you know, the one demon who the guy talks to, who sort of seems like he's sort of a lesser demon. Like he can be eaten. Mm-hmm. He's a wolf. But his you know, he's suffering because he was a farmer, and as a farmer, to keep prices high, he dumped a bunch of milk and a bunch of stuff that people could eat into. And you know, he was sort of, when I was thinking about that, I was thinking, you know, that's horrible, but it's also horrible in the way that any of us who are complicit in a kind of, say, capitalistic system are being horrible every second.
Yeah.
You know, like when I pay my taxes, I'm paying for bombs, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, mostly, in fact.
Yeah.
And so so it kind of calls to question this way of like, you know, how are, you know, are we demons? You know, are we demons? He didn't seem special to me. You know, that demon didn't seem special. That when he that demon was like, this is what I did. I was like, oh damn, yeah, me too.
Yeah. Yeah. And even it's like in this, the aftermath of this like nuclear apocalypse and like the demons, he's a one horn demon. And then those with like two and three horns are at the top of this food chain, essentially, because they all, they depend on, and so they're still in a hierarchy within this. But he talks about how like those demons, even as they are at the top of this food chain, are cursed with eternal life. And like, they're going to suffer pain over and over and over again, and that like there's no escape for them. And so it's like, okay, if you did this in your life, what did those folks do to like have to suffer, you know? And it's just a consideration of like, what does it mean for your actions in this life, in this world, to have consequences beyond what you can feel immediately?
Which is precisely a certain, precisely might be the wrong word, but which is approaches a definition for alienated life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't understand the consequences of your behavior at all, which is you know, precisely what we're counseled and trained to do. You know, that is the job of a kind of consumer. Rampant consumer culture is not to know what, because once you know your farmer, once you know the creatures your farmer is interacting with and tending to and maybe feeding you from, and you know, and the land that your farmer, or if you are yourself the farmer, things are different. You know, things are different. You know, it's like the more alienated we are, the more captive in a way we are. We don't even know, we don't even know we belong to the river.
There's something else that I was struck by in that particular vignette, because it's where our sort of guide through all of this, the dreamer himself, is like coming upon this demon, and the demon sort of showing him like what the wreckage is, and he's just like, We have these terrible plants or something, and it's just these huge dandelions, right? These overgrown weeds that, like, if any of us, like, in our day, like, that's something that, like, my mom would have picked out of the ground to make sure that things remain pristine, but here they are. And there's one, it's feeling like, okay, the aftermath of our human folly is the overgrowth of these like invasive species, these weeds that we don't want. But then thinking through and being like, well, at this point, like, that's the only source, like, they're rendered so beautifully and vibrant. It's like, that's the only source of beauty left is in this world. And it's like, they're sort of like, they're letting them do their thing. It's kind of like, because what else do we have to like see that will like connect us to any sense of our humanity?
I know. I love it. You know, because I'm like a proselytizer of the dandelion, which is like useful at the bottom. You know, like you can eat the flowers, you know. Yeah. The greens are really healthy. The roots, you know, you can use. There's medicine. I was laughing because when I saw that, I was like, oh man. But because it's like a fallout zone, it's like, yeah, but you better not eat the dandelions, you know. But I was sort of thinking about that. I was like, oh yeah, that's the thing. Like dandelions, like you said, like they're the thing. They're the thing that's able to survive in this sort of devastated landscape, you know. That in the waking life, maybe, of the dreamer or of a lot of us, the dandelion is like, we think of it as something that's to be removed. But in a certain kind of way, you know, there's this moment where it's like, well, the dandelion might cast shade for you, actually. Because it's so big, you know, and it's like a thing. I would say, you know, it's like, it's so crazy. It's really, really great. Really great. It's kind of funny, too, because it's like one of those moments I was noticing in the movie, that there's these moments where it seems like the technology of the time is sort of very different than the technology of our time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it had those moments of like, I don't know how you say it, like a little bit corny, is a little bit corny at some moments. Like the voice get a little bit like, you know, it was like someone like when Stevie Wonder was playing on the Casio all the time. Like he was the best in the world, but it was like, well, sometimes that kind of sounded corny.
Yeah.
But it was, the voice sometimes of like, you know, when the mountain men and that voice, that demon eventually kind of, it sounded like, okay, someone was like working on like a little effect there, you know?
Yeah. Which is interesting to think of just sort of like in terms of like filmmaking and thinking about this as like late era Kurosawa and being like, okay, so here is someone who is like renowned for his storytelling technique, his framings, all of that stuff. But it's 1990 now. And it's like, so well, how does he make use of what technology is available to him? And like, there's a part of you that's kind of like you're sort of describing with Stevie Wonder, right? Where it's like, but I kind of want you to just do the thing that you've done. Cause that's but there's also that would be limiting to the artist, right? To say like, just continue to not, don't engage with what progress we've made at all. But then at the same time, Kurosawa is kind of saying we shouldn't in a way.
Yeah. I was thinking of that too. Like, what are the I was feeling like I so admire that, you know, one of the best filmmakers of all time is experimenting still. Yeah. Like, is in his practice, and you know, which, you know, I aspire to be, and I admire when I see folks who are like, yeah, I'm not just dialing it in, like I'm trying to do something I don't know how to do, which is why also like I feel like I remember some of the dreams I remember more powerfully, and in a way I wonder if that's, I mean, I think that's probably like a, actually this is what I've been thinking lately, is that people who are really good at stuff, who make beautiful things, also make unbeautiful things, you know? That's actually like, to me, that's a quality, you know? Mm. It's like, you make stuff and you're trying hard, some of the shit you make should not be beautiful.
Right.
It's just what it is, you know? And so like, the one about, you know, kind of Van Gogh one, I never cared about that one. And I realized, I've only, you know, watched that movie 10 times maybe, and I've only probably watched that one once. And then I was watching, I was kind of like, oh, this is a funny one, because this is like a dream where the dreamer is having a conversation in France, but he's speaking English to Martin Scorsese playing Van Gogh. Like, what a weird dream, you know?
Weird dream.
So I was sort of like, but I kind of got behind that, where I was sort of like, that's, it's goofy, you know? I don't know that Kurosawa was like, yeah, this is a dream, where I was like, you know, talking to Scorsese. but still, you know, it's like one of these ones, like, yeah, like I don't have to love everything. You know, I don't think and he doesn't have to make everything good, you know? Right.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's exactly what you're saying. If you are striving for beauty and greatness, however you want to define that term, like, it's an inevitability to fall short, because the pressure to produce at that level is such a stress that, like, how could you, right? Yeah. And it's to say, like, within even the, like, you can look at any piece of art that you love and find some fault in it, right? Yeah, and part of it is, though, that like those things help add the texture to it that like make you appreciate the thing, the heights that are reached, but also are, I mean, it's sort of like the, you know, the Japanese like art of kintsugi, right? Where it's like we intentionally break the thing and then put it back together so that you can see all of the lines of how this thing, like of how the breaking of it and the faultiness of it come together in some sense of beauty. And it's like, yeah, like I don't need everything to feel exactly perfect. I think, this is another where it makes me think of like, people would have conversations, and this is a little before my time, but like people have conversations debating Michael Jackson versus Prince, right? And where I would come to it like is feeling like Michael went in the studio and tried to make a perfect pop song every single time. Yeah. And Prince went in and just made music, right? And it's just like, here's a free experience. Like, and so some of it works. Some of it is just like incredibly, like it's the best music that you ever heard. And some of it, it's just like, But what you see is an artist at work, like doing it all, experimenting, feeling through it all. Whereas like there's something, and this is not to say that like Michael Jackson's work or any like perfectionist like this is doesn't achieve at times what they're trying to achieve, but there is something a little more sanitized about it. Something that's that like missing of that like human element.
Totally. Yeah. And that's why like, you know, I'm way more interested in live performance than I am studio performance. You know, I'm way more interested if we can get a hold of some, you know, practice tapes or like, I'm way more interested in that. Usually, you know, I'm interested in the final thing, but I'm really moved by people. And I'm also moved by people's final stuff, like Prince sometimes. That is the evidence of that is itself like very conscious of or not afraid anyway of being practiced. You know, my buddy writer Patrick Rosal, I don't know who he's quoting, but it's like maybe a Cuban percussionist or something who says something like if you're not practicing, you're not doing it. you're always practicing, and so. You know, in a way, so like, I feel like, you know, as we get older and we sort of, you know, get some skills and we get some things we're really good at, and then we're sort of continuing to make work. If we're just making work we're really good at, you're not practicing.
Right.
And the thing about practicing is that, you know, whatever you're practicing, if you're actually, you know, like I coach a lot of basketball and like, you know, your kids to like do drills, you know, to like dribble between their legs really fast or trying to like pound the ball. Mm-hmm. We're always saying, do it hard enough and fast enough till you lose it. Do it harder than you can do it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, do it in a way, you know, put these two things together, you know, like use this technology that's sort of new, you know, and it's developing. See what happens.
See what happens.
And like, damn, to me, I'm like, every once in a while, I was kind of like, well, that's all right. And every once in a while, it's like, I'll never forget that image for the rest of my life.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah, like it's that the Van Gogh one that you're talking, it's a little corny that he's like sort of walking through the painting, maybe like it's a little, but then there's like just stuff that feels like you know, it's still contains the elements that you're familiar with from Kurosawa, but then there's the experimental elements that like maybe these are the things that may sit with you and maybe be like, here's something to ponder. Here's something to consider. Here's something that like, cause I'm sitting here thinking about it. It's like, yeah, that vignette sort of stands out in this way where everything else feels very pointedly about like this ecological disaster that's man-made and like the tragedy of like humans at war with one another, destroying the natural world, all of that stuff, and feeling like there's a sense of everything being out of control. And here's this little vignette where the dreamer is talking to Martin Scorsese as Van Gogh, which I can't get over that it's Scorsese.
But, like, then he talks exactly like Scorsese. Yeah, he talks exactly like Scorsese. Right? He's trying to talk like an idea of like.
But then he like follows him and then he's going through the Van Gogh paintings and there's this sense of just like like in the midst of all of this, maybe there's something to just getting lost in art, right? Like what if that like helps you connect to that natural world, right? Like that's what Van Gogh was attempting to do. He was attempting to capture it and trying to you know, preserve it in a way that felt like meaningful to him. And so like walking through that painting, even though the image looks a little off, it's a little corny, but it's to say that there's still something that like Kurosawa wants us to search and ponder.
And what I love too, is that the conceit of the movie, it makes it such that it was like, well, in the dream, I was actually walking through the painting. I know it looks corny because sometimes dreams are corny.
Sometimes
I was walking, you know, I was like, you know, and sometimes they're terrifying. Yeah. And sometimes dreams end abruptly, like, you know, the dream that's so one of the many to me, like the image of like that commander or whatever in the military. Mm. You know, that is such a, I mean, also like in this movie, like the acting, I think, is just like, mm-hmm. you know, like there's that one private who is kind of realizing, oh, I died in the war, and this commander outside this tunnel, which is, it's so dreamy, you know, it's so, and he's sort of approaching him as though he's like at, you know, at service or whatever you call it, at attention and stuff. Mm-hmm. And as he's sort of realizing he's not alive, like he goes from being very erect, very upright, and then his body just it just changes. Mm-hmm. And it's so beautiful and moving to me. And it's just like another thing, sometimes, you know, like probably people who work with Kurosawa a lot, like, you know, good acting.
Yeah.
Good acting, people who can go from being sort of like professional or whatever the thing is, official, to like devastated, mm-hmm. devastated. Like, mm-hmm. while in the midst of being in the presence of their superior.
Yeah.
You know? Like, being like, I'm never gonna see my mom and dad again.
Yeah.
You know? So that too, just like this kind of certain kind of incredibly beautiful acting, I think is, I don't know, it seems hard to come by.
Yeah, for sure. Ross, what's one lasting image that sticks with you from dreams? I know we've talked about so many here, but
yeah, it is that kid walking through the flowers. You know, I mean, I do orchards and I'm a gardener and all that stuff. So many of those. I was actually sort of thinking about how much as a kid, as a, you know, an early 20s person, when I first watched that movie, I hadn't been gardening a lot, but I had grandparents who gardened, and I, you know. But how striking those images of the earth, of the land, of the flower, the wild, so much wildflowers and the were. So that is definitely one of them, that the kid walking on his way, hopefully to be forgiven by the flowers. That's an incredible image. But I'm also really like the image of the, I mean, today, it, like almost like when I was watching this last night, I mean, it, the kid crying about the orchard, like it, mm-hmm. oh my God, it's just like so moving. But the orchard for a moment being back was also incredible. Yeah. I could do other, I could go on and on. You know, those guys, those mountaineers, like just them, like kind of, God, wake up. Oh my God.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, two meant to be rapid questions, but sometimes they aren't for people. What is your all-time favorite film?
I don't think I have one. I have movies that I love so much that I've seen again and again and again. But I'm hard on like a favorite thing, on a number one thing. Yeah.
Get you.
Yeah, I could give you a list of like 20, right. But it would take me a little while. But I'll say dreams.
Oh. What is a film that best captures the idea of family for you?
I love that question. You know that movie, My Cousin's Wedding, Charles Burnett? My Cousin's Wedding, My Brother's Wedding. I forget the title right now. And there's this moment in that, you know, like there's this kind of kid, like protagonist who's probably like in his 20 or something, and he's just like a 20-year-old dude, you know, but there's this moment, like he has a kind of like a very regular relationship with his folks, and it's loving, and kind of like he's a pain in the ass, or he's like, I don't know, whatever. And there's this moment where he and his father, his folks run a laundromat, and he and his father, he's in there like doing some helping out, or maybe not helping out enough or whatever, but he and his dad like start wrestling.
Okay.
And when I saw that the first time, I think I cried. It was like this actual beautiful depiction of like, you know, black father and son, like fucking around each other, like wanting to kind of tussle, you know, And it was at that moment, it was like I realized, oh, that thing is not something that I see very often actually in movies, you know? And that's one of the most, you know, and the mom is there like, you guys, she's like trying to like work. She's like, I don't know, like moving the laundry around. And she's like, bumping into her. She's like, God damn it, like, it's too late. And these dudes love each other so much. They're always trying to like, you know, they're also trying to win the little wrestling.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful to me. There's another one too, though, and this is a short film, like a very short film by the filmmaker, maybe like experimental filmmaker, you'd say, Kevin Jerome Everson.
Okay.
He's really beautiful, beautiful filmmaker, but he has this short movie. It's probably 2.5 minutes called Sister, and it's just like after a funeral. Mm-hmm. It's just like silent black and white movie of people after a funeral. And it's just as beautiful a thing as I know. Yeah.
Ross, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, it's good to talk to you. Yeah, I hope we get to do it again.
Thanks for listening to Open Form, a podcast from Lit Hub Radio, produced by Eliza Smith and Justin Alvarez, and hosted by me, Michael Denzel Smith. Feel free to like, comment, and subscribe to Open Form wherever you get your podcasts, and or sign up for the Lit Hub newsletter to stay up to date on our latest episodes. If you're enjoying what you hear, share Open Form with a friend or on social media. Next week, ease on down the road.